Hi guys, I'm coming to you today from Melbourne. And for those of you not from Australia or who haven't been to Melbourne before, Melbourne is sort of down towards the bottom of the country, which in Australia, in the Southern Hemisphere, means we're getting down towards the cold stuff. So we're obviously just coming out of winter here, and Melbourne has a bit of a reputation for having sort of four seasons in a day. At the moment, it's a pretty good season. It looks like it's kind of sunny outside, but based on the last couple of days at least, that's probably not going to last. I didn't go outside and find a nice spot. I'm just really pressed for time today because I've got to go and run this workshop, which I'll talk about in a moment. So I am coming to you from yet another hotel room. But I'm only going to be here for another couple of days and then I'll be home. So I'll come to you from home next week before jetting off overseas again. So I am in Melbourne doing workshops again. So I'm here for, actually here for the OWASP APSEC Day. And the APSEC Day will be tomorrow on Saturday, and I'll do another talk then. But yesterday and today was just more hack yourself first. Or yesterday was, today will be. And look, I mean, again, that's sort of the same thing that I do over and over and over again around the world. And it is really, really nice to be doing it in Australia. I did this in Sydney last month at the NDC conference as well. And I think I realized I'd been traveling too much when I was walking around the conference going, gee, it seems like there's a lot of Aussies around here. Isn't that weird? So I think that's a sign. So anyway, I am definitely going to be trying to do more of these from my home country. And in fact, I've got a few more lined up over Australia for the remainder of the year. So I'll be back in Melbourne again a couple of times and in other parts of the country too, which is cool. So I mentioned tomorrow, I'm going to do a talk tomorrow. I'm doing my Lessons from Billions of Bridged Records talk again. So this is a talk I've done a few times before. I normally kind of adapt them over time as there's new and interesting things. So I've got a couple of different bits that will go into this one. But look, that's always fun. People always seem to enjoy it, and I have a lot of fun doing it. So I'll be doing that. And then first thing Monday morning, back home to the Gold Coast, which is a 2-hour flight within the same country. For those of you, particularly from Europe, going, wow, you can go to a lot of different places in 2 hours. No, I can get to the next state above the next state. So anyway, that'll be that. Now, a few things this week. Just one thing that sort of popped up a few times, and if I'm honest, kind of surprised me that this was getting press. The pwned passwords I did. I did the 320 million pwned passwords recently. And if you recall, this is passwords that have appeared in data breaches. And it's passwords that have obviously then been leaked and obtained by various nefarious parties. And when I put the pwned passwords together, the premise of it was, let's have a great big stash of passwords which should no longer be used. And this was sort of the thing that NIST was saying. They're saying, you know, look, don't use passwords that have appeared in previous breaches. So I obviously have a lot of passwords that are handy, and I wanted to make these passwords available for people in a way that wasn't immediately decipherable. And what I mean by that is that I wanted to give people passwords without them actually seeing what the password was. And the rationale for that is that within the huge stash of passwords I have, inevitably there are people that use their email address as their password, or their home address, or some other personally identifiable attribute. And even though the data has been leaked and spread out there around the web, I don't want to be the guy that's giving plain text passwords which may have other sensitive things about the owner and the identity of the owner. So I went through and SHA-1 hashed them. Now, we've got to be clear about what the purpose of a SHA-1 hash is here. Firstly, don't store passwords in your own system as a SHA-1 hash. Like, that is just gone. We're past that era. Today we're using adaptive hashing algorithms, things like PBKDF2 or Bcrypt, or other things with high workload that are designed to make single logon processes slow, computationally expensive. The purpose of SHA-1 was just to give a thin veneer of obfuscation to the passwords. Now, what I was thinking here is that, look, if we put these out and they're sort of all SHA-1, it will be easy for people to compare passwords with people who are logging on, registering, changing passwords. So you can integrate this into your system, and a lot of people are too, and I've got to write something about this actually. But a lot of people are now doing things where you go to create an account, or someone goes to create an account, someone's entered a password, they check it against this set of hashes, it's quick to hash because it's just a SHA-1 hash, you couldn't do it with salts and things because you're never going to know what password people are going to provide you, so you can't sort of salt the source passwords, and then it just wouldn't make sense. But anyway, so it goes through, you can do a quick check, and it comes back and says, you know, basically yes or no, this password exists. So that's cool. Now, a huge proportion of the passwords, over 90% of the passwords, come from two really big combo lists. So one is called Antipublic, and I've written about this before, and the other one is called ExploitIN. Both of these are in Have I Been Pwned. I have appeared in them as well, so yeah, that's awesome. So these things have been out there, and they are really readily discoverable. Now, I don't link to this stuff, but the number of people that have said, I wanted to find what my password was, so I Googled the particular combo list and I found it. Clearly, it's really easy to data to find. Now, what that means is that if you wanted, for argument's sake, to take that great big list of SHA-1 pwned password hashes and crack them, you would just go and download the original passwords. And of course, if you downloaded the original passwords, it's kind of pointless to then go and crack the list of SHA-1 hashes, but if you wanted to, then there's your password dictionary. So you take that and you hash each one, you compare it, and you go, oh yes, look, I found the right one. So, you know, the whole point of someone could actually crack a large portion of the hashes is kind of totally irrelevant when the data is available in other places very readily anyway. So the interesting thing that sort of popped up this week is there's a Twitter account, Sinoprime Sure. I think I got that right. Apologies if I didn't. And these are the guys or the girl or the, I don't know who it is. It's just a Twitter account who managed to identify the Ashley Madison hashes. So Ashley Madison stored hashes bcrypt. They managed to find a really shoddy implementation, which also meant that the data was available, I think from, I can't recall if it was a ZMD5 or SHA-1 hashes or some other sort of screwy tangential piece of the data was available in the system and effectively invalidated the Ashley Madison hashes. So they did some really cool work. And they pinged me on the SHA-1 hashes and said, we're cracking them. And I went, okay, well, good on you if you want to, but all the data's there anyway. And, you know, they managed to crack, I think, 99.something% of them, which is about right, because there's always going to be a little portion which is, it's come from other places which they might not have. There's always going to be a little portion where there's import processes that have been kind of clunky. So a really good example is some of that, I think it was particularly the ExploitIN data. There were, I can't remember the total number of password and username pairs, I think it was like 750 million or something ridiculous like that. And there were some records in there which weren't nicely delimited, where they didn't just have an email address and say a semicolon and a password, but they actually had some other crap in there. And of course, when I import it, I'm not looking at 750 million individual records. So some of them had a bit of junk in them. And I guess the interesting thing that sort of unfolded from here is that they've done a write-up and said, you know, here's how long they took to crack, and we can all sort of marvel at how useless SHA-1 is in terms of the speed. And again, it's how useless it is if you're using this to store passwords in your own system, which you need to protect from other people. It's very different if you're just using this in the context of pwned passwords. But anyway, somehow the media has managed to pick up on this, and they've picked up at how quick it was to crack hashes. And also that inevitably they found that, as I originally said in the blog post, there is some personal data in there as well, which of course is very hard to weed out when you've got 750 million records in there. So yeah, somehow that popped into the media too, the fact that there was some personal data in there and there's 320 million records. And frankly, none of it's really been critical, I guess, of the pwned password things. It's more sort of been an observation of how quickly stuff can be cracked in SHA-1. But I was just kind of surprised at how it kept popping up in stories. And I had one of the journos I often work with contacted me, and he's like, it's a slow news day and we're thinking about covering this. And we kind of talked through it, and he went, there's not actually a story here, is there? So, and I suspect that the Sinoprime Sure guy or guys or girls are probably a little bit surprised by it too. Now, incidentally, they did offer, we've been chatting them, they said, look, we'll give you a set of the hashes which we think contained personal data. And I'll go through and I'll exclude those from future sets of pwned passwords because I am going to do new versions. Now, that doesn't change the fact that they're there in the other one. And it certainly doesn't change the fact that they're there in the source data that you can go and download from somewhere else anyway. So anyway, that was just sort of one of these things which I was kind of like, why are we talking about this? But anyway, we'll move on past that. While I'm having a little bit of fun first thing in the morning, something really weird popped up on my Twitter yesterday, and I thought I'd share this. I shared it on Twitter. If you recall, there was an incident a few weeks ago where an SEI, it is early and I haven't had coffee yet, an SEO guy wrote about, look, you probably don't need HTTPS for various things. You know, you probably don't need it if it's just a blog or if it's not an e-commerce site. And the way this sort of all unfolded is I left a very polite, constructive comment, and he went through and deleted that and everything else. And then eventually a lot of people sort of said, no, that advice about not needing HTTPS is actually not very good. And he deleted the whole video. But I'd written about it at the time, because when people go through and start deleting constructive comments, particularly when it relates to how to better protect people online, you know, that's not real cool. And I think I titled it something like, don't take security advice from psychics and SEOs, because one of the ladies who had given similar advice a while ago, who had claimed to be reincarnated by a psychic or something just totally wacky, she had given very, very similar advice. And there'd been a discussion at the time with this SEO lady about, actually, yes, you do need HTTPS for all these reasons. And every now and then she kind of pops up again. Someone tweeted me yesterday because she popped up leaving a comment on one of her own blog posts. And she talked about me. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. It's always kind of curious when people talk about you online. And I won't go through the whole thing here because it's quite a long comment. But she said, apparently I was encouraging my fellow friends to make fun of me. And see, this is hard, because if you point to bad HTTPS advice and say it's bad HTTPS advice, well, some people may make fun, but I didn't try to make fun of it. What is he going here? Oh, she, rather. he used his fake Twitter accounts to bombard my other tweets, which were about defamation and anti-cyberbullying with crappy comments, and called me names. I think I called her Maria, and I called her a psychic because the article she was in said she was a psychic. But yeah, the Twitter accounts is funny, actually, because what was kind of curious, and I haven't actually gone through my tweets this morning, so I don't know all the feedback to this, but I quote tweeted one of her accounts. She seems to have a lot of sock puppet accounts. So, and first of all, apologies to all the genuine SEO people out there, because I had a lot of people contact me after I wrote this post saying, we actually work in SEO, we actually know what we're doing, we're really sorry that there are people like this spreading just rubbish around, and you know, we feel bad because it tarnishes all of us. So it tarnishes all of them. So one of the things that I've learned about some of the sort of shady, dodgy SEO stuff is that they do have a huge number of sock puppet accounts. So accounts that do nothing else other than chime in and retweet and like, and basically try and artificially inflate the significance or the interest of a piece. So I retweeted one of these. Yes, I said, it's interesting to have a look at these sock puppet accounts, because there was basically an account which made a tweet which was inane and pointless and didn't really make any sense. And it's got like hundreds of likes and retweets. No comments or actual engagement by humans. But it's really funny when you go through and look at that. So I don't know how I'm using fake accounts, but anyway. apparently I DDoSed her, which is interesting. Troy Hunt started all the circus. DDoS attacked my website the same day. So I suspect that what's happened is that when you tweet and say, hey, look, here's something crazy, and you've got 80,000 followers, a bunch of them go and look at something crazy. And in that regard, yes, it is possible that my followers were interested enough in seeing the crazy that it actually DDoSed the thing. So it certainly wasn't me running booters or anything like that, which is kind of weird. All these mumbo jumbos are for telling people the truth about SSL TLS. This is where it kind of gets a bit anti-vaxxer. So the interesting thing here is that there seems to be a genuine belief that SSL TLS is useless or pointless or fabricated. And I won't go through the rest of it. I might actually link to the tweet where I shared this, because you can read it and like get a beer or something, sit down, relax, popcorn, read it then. But she sort of goes on a bit, and the really interesting thing here is that the argument against SSL TLS, incidentally, The lady seems to be rebranding herself as a security person as well, which is kind of curious. But at the end, she says, SSL TLS is not safe. Read this article about SSL TLS-based malware attacks. And what the article is saying is, guess what? A lot of malware is now using TLS because you can get certificates from Let's Encrypt and so on for free. And her conclusion is somehow that means TLS is not safe. When really, it's quite the opposite. What it means is that TLS is doing a very good job of what it's designed to do. Unfortunately, there's malicious stuff in the traffic. Oh, also, apparently I called Neil Patel Pajama Boy, which I never use those two words together. And I got to admit, as someone else on Twitter said, I did just about spit out my tea when I read this, which was kind of interesting. Anyway, look, I don't want to get into that because frankly, this sort of stuff becomes a bit of a distraction. And there's actually interesting, useful stuff to do. Speaking of which, this week I wrote about Amplify. Now, Amplify is a product made by Ubiquiti, and I've spoken a lot about Ubiquiti's Unify range. And just for context again, last year I was having just crazy problems with my Wi-Fi. Just the routers would continually sort of drop down to 2 megabits. I'd have to reboot them. Linksys, who made them, were frankly not particularly useful. They're like, yeah, we'll send you another one. And then you go through and you read online and people are like, yeah, this happens all the time. So I went out and said, all right, folks, like, what do I do in terms of getting a good internet or good Wi-Fi? And a lot of people are saying Ubiquiti. So I went and spent over $2,000 buying all of this Ubiquiti stuff to totally kit out the house. And I totally overkilled it. I was so fed up with the Wi-Fi. I was like, I'm just going to get so much Wi-Fi stuff in here. I'm not going to have any more problems. And I did that and I was like, this stuff is really, really awesome. And I wrote a blog post and one thing led to another. And obviously the blog post got a lot of attention. A lot of people went and bought Unify. A lot of very happy people. And I wrote a few other pieces. They sent me a few bits. I wrote a course on Unify, which I spoke about very recently. It was a commercial course. They paid me to do that. So I want to be very, very clear about all the things I do and do not get paid for. Incidentally, I'm writing a blog post on how I make those decisions too, about what I will do for money and how I make sure that it's really, really transparent. Because the last thing you want is people to go, oh, you're talking positively about something because they gave you money for it. Now, when I did that course and they sent out the bits that I then put in the restaurant for the course, they also sent me a box of Amplify. And if we sort of look at Unify and Amplify, Unify is like, this is the prosumer kind of gear where people like myself and quite possibly yourself as well, who are a bit techie, can go and put it in your homes. But it's also the same gear that will go all the way through into massive stadiums and huge shopping center rollouts. So that needs a sort of a higher degree of technical capacity. Amplify is the more mainstream consumer grade stuff. It comes in a very nicely packaged box. It feels very Apple-like when you take it out. And they sent me this box and I was sort of trying to figure out what to do with it because to be honest, I don't need any more Wi-Fi in my house, but my parents do. So they have, they do still have, I'll come back to that. They have an old Billion all-in-one device. And in fact, I had the Billion ones before I got the Linksys ones, and they must date back to about a decade ago. And it is like one unit in one corner of the house. It just does what it always does. It has never, ever, ever received any sort of update. So I went and got the Amplify bit, and what it consists of is there's effectively a base station, and it is a cube, sort of about yay big. And you put that base station, it's got 4 Ethernet ports for the LAN on the back and one to go to the WAN, back out to your modem. You have to have an upstream modem, which is why the Billion one is still there. Anyway, you sort of plug that in, you go through a setup process on your phone. You can also go through a setup process on the screen. It's got like a round screen in the middle of it. And then once you're sort of set up, and that takes a few minutes, you have these Amplify mesh points. And they almost look like white ones and they plug straight into the PowerPoint and they've got a nice little aerial and you put these mesh points at other spots in the house where you want Wi-Fi. And they then uplink to the base station. They can also wirelessly uplink to each other as well. So you can go like mesh point to base station, depending on how you configure the house. And I put these in the home at mum and dad's and it was kind of cool because I was like, imagine that I'm just an everyday consumer and I had to try and figure out how this works, you know, could I do it? And I basically just went through, followed the instructions on the app. It took I think I said like 39 or 49 minutes or something like that to get everything set up. And that included me taking screen grabs and starting to draft the blog post. So it was very, very basic. And it's actually a really neat implementation. There's stuff in there which I wish was in Unify. So for example, it's easy to pull out the app and go, I would like to pause one particular device on the network. And you can see your list of devices and you can see how much data they're pulling down. And that's particularly useful for mum and dad because they get 4 megabits down where they live, and Netflix will work over 4 megabits, but it won't work over much less than 4 megabit. So they can sort of, you know, sit there on the couch, they're watching, want to watch Netflix, it's buffering, have a look at the list of devices, oh, the PC is pulling down an update, pause, that gets put on hold, Netflix assumably resumes. So that's kind of cool. Setting up things like guest networks are kind of cool. So it was very easy just to go, hey, guest network, start the network. And the cool thing is by default, they're time limited. So you say, I want to start my guest network. I want it to run for 2 hours. The less cool thing, and I did say this in the blog post, is that when you start that guest network, it doesn't have a password by default. You can go into settings and turn it on. I think that should be secure by default. I also think the other thing they should have done differently is that when you actually first set up the device, you go through, you create an SSID, it asks for a password. By default, it will use the same password for the admin of the system. I get that from a consumer-friendly facing perspective where you can go, hey, this is the password for your network, and then you use that both when you're connecting devices and when you're connecting to admin. The obvious problem though is that if you let someone connect to that normal primary network and you give them the password, now they have the password for your admin. But you know, on the other hand, you're probably not going to have people connecting to your network that you give the password to that you wouldn't trust to then go in and screw up all your settings. But I would prefer to see those as two different passwords by default. So that was that. I guess the other things there in terms of bits that were really nice was the unit itself has got this round display on it where you can see things like the current up speed and down speed, the total up and down bandwidth over a period of time, what ports are in use, what IP has been assigned to both LAN and WAN ports, all this sort of stuff. Theirs is presently double NATing as well, so I've got to put the upstream device into bridge mode yet, but it's at least it's functional. So that was Amplify. I think the interesting thing that people ask is they go, okay, well, should I get Amplify or should I get Unify? And in the blog post, I sort of talk about different options. And the first easy thing is that if you're not technical, get Amplify, because Unify does take some more thinking. If you are technical, you can kind of go either way. And I recently saw my friend Scott Hanselman. He was asking about these, you know, should I get Unify, etc. And I had a chat to him and said, look, I think, you know, the Unify is awesome because of these reasons. But he elected to go Amplify, and he's a very technical guy, and he's very, very happy with what he's got because he doesn't want to sit there thinking about network configuration, and that's fine. So I think that's one of the criteria. If you really want this just to be a utilitarian device that you set up and you put out there, Amplify is awesome. Where I think Unify is most useful, where the easiest argument for Unify is that if you're setting up a new house, if you're building a new house, if you're renovating, if you can drill holes in walls, I would deck the whole thing out with Unify like I did for my brother's house. And I referenced that in the blog post where we put the in-wall units in 7 of the rooms. So you go through every bedroom's got a nice flush panel on the wall that does Wi-Fi, and it's got 2 jacks on the bottom as well. And then it Ethernet's back and there's a switch and a patch board and all that sort of thing. And it's in a nice little compact server cabinet. So that is a beautiful setup. I'd do that. I would also do it anywhere where you're going to have longer distances and you don't want to wirelessly uplink. So in my home, for example, we have wired Ethernet ports in each room, and they're just normal RJ45 points, and I've now got Unify access points sitting next to them, so it's not as pretty as my brother's. But that's great because we've actually got wired backlinks back to a switch as opposed to trying to do wireless all through the home. You're never going to be as good or as fast with wireless as you are when you have actual wires running through to switches. So anyway, have a read of the blog post. If you're thinking about doing network bits, that's really awesome. And frankly, also, there is a case to be made for just not changing at all, just sticking with your old consumer grade thing if you've got enough signal coverage already and you don't need the other features. So have a think about that too, but I'm really happy with the way it works. And I've got to go back to mum and dad's and have a look at all the metrics and stats now and see how it's been going. All right, so last thing is Gold Security is sponsoring me again this week, or sponsoring TroyHunt.com. So big thanks to those guys. It's been really good having them on multiple times now. Sponsorship is full through to, I think, the start or the end of sometime in November. So that's cool. I need to actually be a bit more proactive this time and think about asking for sponsors more than like a week before I actually have none. So with that in mind, if you're interested in sponsoring my blog, there's a sponsor link up the top. So hit on that and let me know. So thanks very much for watching. I'm going to be back on the Gold Coast on Sunday. I'll come to you from the Gold Coast Friday next week, and then I'll come to you from Salt Lake City the week after that, because I'll be over there for Pluralsight Live. Thanks, guys. See you later.